You're listening to the APC Podcast, the Association of People Supporting Employment First, with your host, Chris Davies. Today's podcast is brought to you by Reach for Resources, a nonprofit providing individualized, competitive employment services for people with disabilities. We believe our community is a better place when it is inclusive and everyone, regardless of ability, has the chance to be successful. Learn more at reachforresources.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Minnesota APC Podcast, Season 4, Episode 4. I am your host, Chris Davies, and we are delighted to be here today with Samuka Terakanambi. How are you doing today, Samuka?
Doing good. How are you?
Wonderful. Wonderful. We're very glad you're here. I think everybody's really going to enjoy getting to know you here today and a little bit about your personal journey and the things that are important to you. I know I'm excited to have this discussion.
Yeah. Thanks for having me today.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming in. So, Samuka, as you and I were just talking a minute ago, when we start these podcasts, I always like to let anybody that's never heard of Minnesota APC know a little bit about, you know, who we are and what we represent. So if you're brand new to this podcast and brand just hearing about the Association for People Supporting Employment First for the first time, we are so glad you're here. We are the only membership organization, the national membership organization, that is solely committed to promoting customized, integrated, competitive employment for all. And we have a Minnesota chapter, obviously, and we've been doing this podcast now for 4 years. As I said, this is season 4, episode 4, so a lot of symmetry here today, and it's a Friday. Not that anybody out there, you know, they might be listening, it could be any day, but we're recording on a Friday, and that's my favorite day of the week, so I'm happy. How about you?
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Good stuff. So, as you know, we like to start out also by just giving a visual description of ourselves, and I'll start. So for everybody out there, I am a white male. I am balding. We were joking around. I shave my head about every 4 days. I'm about 3 days of growth in here today. So it used to be red, but now it's just, you know, blah, whatever it looks like. But I'm balding, and I am wearing a button-down shirt, kind of an aloha shirt here today. So, and also I have a red beard. So please tell us about you.
Yeah, so I'm an Asian Indian male. I have black hair, black beard, and a black mustache. I'm wearing glasses. I'm wearing a blue shirt and black pants, and I'm sitting on a power wheelchair.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. Well, let's get into it. As I like to say, you know, we always, every time we have a podcast, really the first thing we love to do is just learn more about who you are, you know? So could you just, you know, the canvas is yours, as I like to say, just tell us, you know, a little bit about yourself, your personal background, growing up, whatever you want to tell us.
Yeah, so I can start out. Again, hi, everyone. My name is Samuka Terakanambi. I'm 25 years old, and I'm from Lakeville, Minnesota. I am a person with a disability, so I was diagnosed with a condition called Duchenne muscular dystrophy when I was about 4 years old. Right now, I use a power wheelchair to get around as my main mode of mobility. And I'm also right now working as a policy consultant with the Minnesota Council on Disability and the Rare Disease Advisory Council. So that's kind of what I'm doing in terms of my employment. And I can go into more detail about my background as well.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about, you know, growing up and maybe when you were sharing with me the other day in conversation when you learned that you had a diagnosis of muscular dystrophy and sort of what transpired through your early years.
Yeah, so when I was officially diagnosed, I was still 4 years old, so I really did not know what was going on. It was mostly my parents who were kind of dealing with the diagnosis and kind of the uncertainty around that. So they had noticed kind of some signs of weakness and fatigue when I was growing up, about when I was around 2 years old. They started noticing that I wasn't, I was kind of lagging behind my peers, in terms of motor skills and things like that. They just noticed I was getting tired very often. I was, walking up the stairs very, gingerly. So I wasn't, developing like most kids. And that's kind of when they started getting concerned. And, even the teachers at the preschool also noticed that I was not where I needed to be for, a kid my age. So that's when, my parents consulted a pediatrician, and went to the University of Iowa, neurology clinic to ultimately get my, confirmed diagnosis of DMD. And so, yeah, at that age, obviously I didn't really know too much about what was going on. I can kind of, speak a little bit to what my parents went through a little bit just based on what they, told me. You know, it was a difficult time, obviously, getting a diagnosis like DMD. For those of you who don't know, DMD is a progressive neuromuscular disease. So it affects, all muscles, including involuntary muscles like the lungs and heart. When my parents received that diagnosis, at the time, the life expectancy was about 16 years of age. So, it was basically very hard news, to hear, and took a while to kind of, accept the news and kind of, for my parents to decide that, you know, they were going to focus on making sure I had every opportunity and things like that, which they did. That I think was kind of the, initial reaction to the diagnosis was obviously sadness and kind of not knowing what to expect with the diagnosis, but then ultimately deciding that, it was not good for them to be depressed about the situation. And so my parents kind of took the situation as it was and kind of did everything they could to make sure I could have, a normal life just like anyone else. So, that was very important. I would say when I started to come to know a little bit, so just for some context, I did have muscular dystrophy. If you had known me when I was younger, you probably couldn't tell unless I told you that, I had it. So it was a little bit less visible at the time. I could walk. I could, to some extent, I could play, sports with other kids. I could run around. Those were not, that didn't become a challenge until I was about 11 years old. Then I started noticing, that, because the disease is progressive. So, even though we were doing different treatments and things like that, ultimately that's the characteristic of the disease. You start to slow down. And so I started slowing down around, 11 years old. It was getting more difficult to walk, get up from myself if I fell, get up from the ground, if I fell, and it was just getting very difficult. And that's when I learned that I had a progressive, condition. And, I was still very young, so I didn't take the news particularly well. I think mostly what I dealt with was a lot of embarrassment. I didn't want people to know that I had a disability. So I try to, I just didn't feel comfortable telling people about it or talking about it very much with others. I was really frustrated, upset with how things were going. And this kind of continued, I would say, even into, high school, just this feeling that, you know, doing well in school, why does that matter? I used to think like it wouldn't matter anyway, because, you know, I have this disability and things are always going to be challenging. So I kind of had that negative outlook. And then also I would get sad a lot, like, you know, the asking questions like why me and all those kinds of things. So, that's kind of the negative emotions I was dealing with at the time. And I think it took a lot of, a time to kind of get over some of those, feelings. I give credit to my parents, my brother and my friends, and our family friends for kind of, helping me develop a more positive outlook. Even the teachers at my high school really, did their best to kind of make sure I was a good advocate for myself. So that's kind of when things, I would say started to change a little bit. I do get frustrated every time, every now and then, just like any other person.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, I think I have realized that having a disability doesn't mean I can't do the things that I want. So, that's kind of the trajectory of how my attitude has changed a little bit.
Yeah, it sounds like, well, first of all, thank you for sharing that with us and, you know, being vulnerable and really speaking from your heart, you know, about your personal story. And I commend you for, you know, working through some very real emotions to a point of, I know when we were speaking the other day, you sort of used a word of acceptance, and then you felt like that helped you move forward. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I would say I've just kind of accepted that the situation is the way it is. I think it's something that has, like, definitely helped with kind of controlling how I feel about mm-hmm. situations, so I don't get depressed or upset as much anymore. I'm able to just focus on what I need to do and not worry about the disability. I'm much more comfortable with sharing about my experiences with others. In fact, that's something that I would say I've improved on a lot, is being able to share my experiences with others. So I've also developed a lot of self-advocacy skills. So really, I've realized that a lot of the challenges I face are because of societal barriers, not necessarily. Obviously, mm-hmm. I face challenges because of my disability, because I do need assistance with most daily tasks. But I think I've realized that being a good advocate is important. So those, I would say that's kind of how I look at things now a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. And it sounds like acceptance doesn't mean complacency. It doesn't mean, oh, well, I'm going to accept this and not live the fullest life I possibly can. It sounds like you are really, you know, using that as a springboard almost to be free of being held back and going after, you know, the things that are important to you. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I would say so. I don't allow my disability to hold me back as much as I maybe did in the past. Mm-hmm. So I have a more positive outlook, and I have been able to do everything that I was able to go to college, get my degree. I have a job as a policy consultant right now, so I've had the opportunity to travel throughout my life. My parents have made sure that I've been able to go to as many places as possible, and so that traveling is there, and then also, I have very good friends that I'm able to hang out with and spend time with. So I think those things, I've been able to do it despite having a significant condition.
Yeah, and those are the things that are important to all of us as human beings. You had mentioned that you got your undergrad degree at University of St. Thomas. Is that right?
Yep, that's correct.
And I think I remember you saying, you know, at that time you really started thinking about accessibility issues. Mm-hmm. You know, can you tell us some maybe specific things or personal stories that really drove you into wanting to focus on making things more accessible, not just for yourself, but for others?
Yeah, I'm just going to go back just a little bit to my high school years, because that's where the self-advocacy skills kind of really started. So previously, my parents were very involved in making sure teachers understood what accommodations I needed. So they were kind of the ones that were advocating for me. I was kind of, I was not as involved. I did know, like, I want things to be this way, but they were kind of my main advocates. But then in high school, the caseworker at my school, the physical therapist, they really put it on me to be the one to tell my teachers, these are the accommodations I need. They also, not just with the advocacy, they also encouraged me to be involved with extracurricular activities and kind of get involved and kind of make friends with other students and things like that. So that really kind of set the stage. I would say it was my junior and senior year where I really started to, initially I was resisting their advice a little bit, but I think then is when I started being very good at telling teachers exactly what I needed, what accommodations I needed, being very clear about that, and then also being more involved in school, whether that was musicals, debate, things like that. I was involved in those extracurricular activities. So that definitely was a foundation for the advocacy I would have to do in St. Thomas. Specifically there, one of the issues was one of the buildings where I had most of my classes in. It was an old building, so sure. It was not meeting any of the ADA standards. Mm-hmm. Really, there just to kind of illustrate how bad it was, there was no elevator. So I did have classes in the basement. There was no elevator. There were no accessible restrooms. So I was at one point going all the way to the student center, which was about 10 minutes away, just to use the restroom, because that building did not have them. The way I was getting down to the basement was I had to go down a small path towards the back of the building to get into the basement level to go to my classes, which was fine when the weather was good. But obviously in Minnesota, you know, the winters are pretty harsh. So it would get very difficult in winter, especially when that area was not cleared of snow and ice. So that was an issue. And then also some of the entrances didn't have the automatic door openers, which is technically not required by the Americans with Disabilities Act, but is obviously very helpful for people with disabilities and even people without disabilities. Mm-hmm. When your hands are full, you can
absolutely. Yeah, it's a universal accommodation.
Exactly. And so none of those were in place. So I had to really advocate. I had to work with the Disability Resource Center make sure that these kinds of so it started with installing a door opener at certain entrances, and then I showed the director of disability services and the vice president of facility management the issues. Like, I can't even get into the door of the restroom, and so even though I feel like the university should have been a little bit more proactive with accessibility, it was at least. It was good that they listened to my concerns and then did something about it. So that building actually got significant renovations over the 4 years I was there. They got an elevator installed. They made all the bathrooms accessible for a person in a wheelchair. They added those door buttons and everything. And so I really had to work with the Disability Resource Center for about 4 years. I spent a lot of my time advocating for issues. It wasn't even that. It was not only that building, there were other issues around campus that I had to bring to the attention of the Disability Resource Center. I'm at least glad that they worked with me and didn't kind of resist once I brought it up. But again, I think the proactiveness was kind of missing in terms of accessibility. And that was kind of when I saw a need for accessibility, especially considering people with disabilities, because I didn't feel like that was being made a priority. And so that kind of is what the situation that kind of made me interested in pursuing a master's of public policy degree to be part of changing the way things are and making sure people with disabilities are included and things like that. So that's kind of the story around that.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's a big deal. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
And, you know, at least from my perspective, it feels like any change for the better for humanity over the history of time doesn't seem to happen unless we're up in the front.
Yep.
Talking about it, talking nice way of saying it, right?
Yeah.
That things need to change. And what an impact not only had, you know, on your time there, but it's something that will continue to help other students. So
yeah,
that's very impressive.
Yeah, and that definitely continued when I was doing my master's as well. I think the University of Minnesota was doing a better job in terms of accessibility, but there's still issues that I had to address even when I was doing my master's as well. So that was something the advocacy for accessibility kind of continued. Even in my master's program, which was unfortunate that those issues still kept coming up, but it was something I had to kind of keep making sure I got. And even there was issues with accommodations where teachers would move classrooms without notifying me, and then I come to find out that the adjustable table for people in wheelchairs is not, there's no room to put one. And so those were some of the challenges that we had to communicate with professors and But for the most part, I think, at least on the professor side, I felt that most of the professors I had were very accommodating when I was in their classes. So that was never an issue. It was mostly the architectural barriers.
Now, what years were you at St. Thomas?
So I was there from 2017 to 2021.
Okay.
And then,
so pretty recently.
Yeah. And then my master's program in public policy was, I graduated in 2023. So
okay.
About a year ago.
Okay. So it sounds like you were getting your master's during the COVID era.
Yeah.
Yep. Did you end up being at home a lot?
I was, I would say like, when COVID started, I was still a junior in college. So
okay.
The end of my junior year was obviously at home. And then St. Thomas opened up pretty early, but they required all the masks and everything. So it was definitely strange to come back to campus and not even recognize it, because there was all sorts of restrictions still at that point. And then master's program, my second year of my master's program, that's when they kind of lifted all of the...
Right. Yeah. 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 Because you said that was like 21 to 23.
Yeah. Yeah. And so definitely the last year of my master's was way more enjoyable, because there was much more happening on campus and things like that. And another thing I wanted to talk about, like specifically with the master's program, like with now that you mentioned COVID, in the disability community, one of the biggest issues was the workforce shortage in home care and like PCAs. Direct support professionals. So that was something that directly impacted me as well when I was getting my master's. My parents are my primary caregivers, but we needed to find someone to help me while I was on campus. And that was very challenging. There literally was no staff available. My case manager had called a number of agencies and people were, they just didn't have the staffing. So my parents were actually with me for the first month. They had to take time out of their busy schedule to kind of assist me on campus, which was pretty difficult because both my parents work. They have their own things going on. So that was a big challenge. And I had to rely on my luckily, I had friends who went to the U, so they were able to fill in and help me. So that was a great, great experience where my friends got to assist me on campus. And I think that really made it enjoyable. Because they could go with me everywhere, and even after they were helping me, we would hang out and things like that. So, but yeah, I think there was a lot of issues with like COVID, especially with the direct support professionals. And I'm obviously thankful that my friends were able to fill in that gap.
Yeah, it sounds like a really natural way to get the support you needed. But you're right. I mean, there is a shortage of direct support professionals, particularly in the area of, PCA and in-home help and things like that. So, but, you know, something you said, really, it's interesting, ties into a kind of a core philosophy of customized employment, which is what APSE advocates for, is that, you know, the most natural way we get support at work is from our coworkers. And so APSE's, you know, what we believe is to help build that bridge, you know, for people at their jobs. So really the people that are helping them out the most, doesn't mean they might not have some help from paid professionals from time to time, but are their coworkers, you know, very similar to what you achieved with their, you know, your personal connections. So,
yeah.
Yeah, that's really good. And so then you, after you got your public policy degree, your master's in public policy, is that when you started working for Partners in policymaking?
So actually, Partners, so I during my master's is kind of when I started getting more into advocacy, like disability advocacy. So My specific degree program, there wasn't a whole lot of focus on disability policy. That was kind of an area where there weren't classes dedicated to disability policy or ADA issues or anything like that. So this was kind of to sort of supplement the learning. Like, so I was learning like the concepts in classes and everything. And I had the flexibility of kind of doing papers on the topics that I was interested in. So there were some where I was able to do disability focused, but I wanted to also be involved in advocacy to kind of learn more about the issue. So that's before I started my master's, I got in contact with the public policy individuals at the Muscular Dystrophy Association.
Okay.
So I got connected with them, and then I joined the Grassroots Advocacy Network. So basically what that is they give us action alerts on different legislation at the federal level.
Sure.
And giving us an opportunity to contact our members of Congress and to kind of let them know why the issue is important. And part of that was they had organized a virtual Hill Day because still obviously COVID was just starting to kind of subside. So I was able to participate in that virtual Hill Day. That was something where I got to talk with my members of Congress and or their staffers about the issues. And so that was one advocacy experience that I had while I was doing my master's. And then another one was Partners in Policymaking. Because of what you learn in Partners in Policymaking, in each of the sessions, they get subject matter experts on a variety of topics, including customized employment. That was actually one of the topics that they touched on. And so Partners in Policymaking was a great program that I was able to be a part of my second year of my master's program. And really, I learned about disability rights, the history of it, different policy areas, gained some more knowledge about the services that are available, and then also learned the importance of developing relationships with my state elected officials, local and even federal.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that really was a great experience to build my self-advocacy skills, but then also learn while I was in my master's. And there was a lot of times where what I was learning in the master's program applied to some of the partners' assignments that we had. And then some of the things I learned in partners were issues that I was able to explore more in depth for research projects for my coursework. So they kind of went together like that. So those were that was when I did Partners in Policymaking. I was also at that time doing an internship at the Minnesota State Senate. So I interned for Senator Hoffman, who is a very vocal advocate for disability rights. So I was able to intern for him, kind of learn more about the legislative process and things
would,
like that.
That would be a great way to learn.
Yeah. So I was kind of kind of seeing the process and how things work. I was attending committee hearings. I was doing some research on actually a lot of employment issues. One of the things I read about and was working on as part of my internship was reading about the Connect 700 program and the legislation that was being proposed to strengthen that program. For people who don't know, Connect 700 is basically like an affirmative action program for people with disabilities within state agencies.
Right.
Unfortunately, there were some significant problems with how people with disabilities were experiencing the program. There were some issues where supervisors are not always accommodating, depending on which agency you were in. So there was a kind of an inconsistent approach. Some agencies did a great job of accommodating, but so that was one of the issues that I kind of dove into when I was at the Minnesota Senate. So that's kind of some of the outside experiences.
Sure.
One other thing I would mention, will mention is like, I also started getting more involved with like, I started getting involved with the steering committee at, the Humphrey School, which is where I went. So they were doing a new strategic plan.
Okay.
And one of the things, I've realized is, DEI doesn't always incorporate people with disabilities. So this was a situation there where I had to make sure I was involved in the committee to make sure accessibility was part of their discussion. So I was able to get some objectives and goals related to accessibility as part of the plan, those were kind of when I started to also get involved in like outside committees. And that's just kind of all of these experiences kind of worked together while I was in my program.
Yeah, it sounds like it really came together for you, and you were very opportunistic, you know, as well.
Yeah.
And I just want to say I totally agree with what you're saying about disabilities not always included in the in a DEI discussion, diversity, equity, inclusion. And I found that when I, you know, got into the employment field that I've been in basically since 1997. I mean, that's what really drew me to this work is that I felt there was, you know, a social justice, if you will, that wasn't being talked about.
Right.
That everyone deserves the opportunity to be a part of their communities. And obviously that includes all the different ways. And one of the most fundamental, of course, is through work. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was definitely something that I was kind of shocked that it wasn't even being considered. So that was it was a little bit at first it was a little bit difficult to get people on the committee, like people who I was working with on the committee, to understand where I was coming from. But I'm glad I was able to work with other students, faculty, and staff to get these things. Even some of them also started to understand a little bit. And then I also even learned from other people as well, what they, cause, there were a few handful of people who were also thinking about disability as well, but, it was just a matter of making sure it's part of the plan.
Cause
if it's not, then I knew they weren't going to do anything, for students with disabilities. So, but yeah, that's just kind of what I was up to while I was, doing my master's. So yeah, those advocacy and my education kind of came together at that point.
Yeah, yeah, it sure did. And, you know, obviously the need for more, accessible environment, you know, across the board, there's so many different areas. Are there any, you know, one or two really specific areas that speak to your heart that you really, you know, want to focus on? For example, at St. Thomas, I mean, obviously that was a real life situation for you when you were really focusing on that specific, accessibility issue. Are there some that really speak to your heart right now that you're focusing on?
Yeah, so accessibility is definitely the big one that I focus on, like just everywhere in the community. It's kind of in a broad sense. Another area that I've done research on and kind of have more, I guess, insight into is employment. That's another area that I've learned more about, particularly like when it comes to the programs that are available to help people get competitive and integrated employment. So I mentioned one of them, which was the Connect 700 program. That was actually what my master's paper was about, kind of how it functions or what are the main challenges and how legislation would address that. So that was kind of what I did. And then employment, like customized employment, I'd mentioned that was one of the topics we covered in partners in policymaking. That's definitely something that advocates are really excited about as being the norm, because right now there's still people who are in sub-minimum wage employment, which obviously depending on the program, it could be less than $4, which is still being practiced in Minnesota. And so it's really important that we're starting to move away from that and towards more things like customized employment, where it was very interesting to hear how the speaker who had come to talk to us about it, he had real life experiences of people with significant disabilities who were doing good work and making at least the minimum wage. So it is possible. There's definitely, it's just a matter of providing the right supports and accommodations. So that's definitely something I'm
absolutely. You'd be a great spokesperson for APSI. You just hit everything on the head that we believe in.
Yeah. So that's definitely something I learned about and saw as definitely an opportunity. And then obviously the reasonable accommodations. That's something that unfortunately not all employers know what that means. There's kind of some the myth is like accommodations are very costly to implement. Sometimes it's very inexpensive. It's just it might be a one-time cost or things like that. There's still a lack of understanding about what a disability accommodation really is. And this was something like, I got to dive into some of the main barriers to employment through a project that I was working on with the Minnesota Council on Disability.
Okay.
Reasonable accommodations and negative stereotypes was one of the barriers that I kind of dove into. So I know, like, unfortunately, there's still a lot of bias against people with disabilities, the idea that they're not productive or they cannot be in a productive environment or things like that, when really it's the accommodations enable them to do what is required by the job. So those were some of the barriers that I explored in the blog posts that I wrote for employment. So that's employment actually ties into a number of issues. I also talked about transportation access, being able to get to and from work, also some of the benefit programs like MAEPD requiring very costly premiums.
Yes.
And
yeah.
It's a huge problem where people can't afford to pay the premium, so they're kind of in the decision between working or keeping medical assistance. And
It seems to be very counterintuitive to what I would think the spirit of medical assistance for employed persons should be about, MAEPD.
Yeah. Thankfully, you know, they at least removed the ACID requirements. That was also something that was part of the program that was recently, they eliminated it. But the premium is the other main issue that advocates are still pushing on, which makes sense because medical assistance is one of the only programs that covers the home and community-based supports, which people need to be independent. But then if they become independent, there's all these penalties. It seems very punitive for people who are trying to work and gain financial independence. There seems to be a lot of penalties still with our program. So that's definitely a barrier.
Yeah, I'm glad you're working on that, you know, with others. Yeah.
And then the other thing with employment was just people being aware of what supports are out there. So sometimes it's people don't know that there are competitive employment options. They don't know about customized employment. So unfortunately, that's why a lot of people still get shuffled towards sub-minimum wage work, is because case managers don't know about the program. So that was another main barrier that I uncovered while I was doing my research for that project. And also I had the opportunity to interview other people with disabilities, and they were kind of sharing some similar struggles, some issues that they were facing in getting employment. So that's really what I've been able to do. So employment is definitely one area. And then I kind of mentioned this already, but healthcare is also another. I talked about MAEPD, which is kind of an intersection of healthcare and employment. But healthcare access is another issue that I've been learning way more about, mostly from the rare disease aspect. So Rare Disease Advisory Council, they advocate for the rare disease community. One of their main goals is to increase access to treatments, therapies, accelerate the rare disease research, and then also making sure people can get the quality of care that they need. So I've been learning a lot more about the challenges, whether that's insurance coverage of treatments, requiring a lot of prior authorization and making it very difficult for people to get their treatments in a timely manner. Those are some issues that I've also kind of become more aware of with my work at the Rare Disease Advisory Council. And then, like I said, medical assistance is another major issue. Like, just there's all sorts of requirements where people still need to get recertified as disabled periodically. Those are all issues that I think make things very difficult for people with disabilities, because life is already challenging and these kind of add to that. The healthcare, employment, transportation was another instance. I was able to share some personal stories about that as well through some of the blog posts I wrote for the Minnesota Council on Disability. So one of the big issues that was discussed this session was transportation network companies like Uber and Lyft being required to provide wheelchair accessible vehicles. Right now, that's a gap in the service. It's not available. So this one was more about pay incentives for people who modify their own vehicles. Or,
sure.
And obviously there needs to be more work on that in terms of providing financial support for people who want to do that. Mm-hmm. But those are some of the things that were being discussed this time in terms
there's
of transportation.
There's a real market for, you know, there's a real need and a market for that. Yeah, I've been saying that for years.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's not only a safety issue, but, you know, I think it's important that people with disabilities can, if they wanted to, go out with their friends at like 10 o'clock at night. They should be able to do that. It shouldn't be dependent on, you know, Metro Mobility not being available or whatever provider not being available at that time. So definitely, and then there's also things like where Metro Mobility has expanded their service hours. That was also through legislation. So there's definitely a lot of things in those three areas that I'm following a lot in addition to accessibility.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Do you mind if I'm going to switch gears a little bit, and I want to just sort of revisit something we were talking about at the beginning. But first, I do want to say it's very clear that you are well-read, well-educated, and well-spoken on all these issues. I'm really glad you're doing what you're doing. It definitely feels to me like you have really found your niche, your advocation.
Yeah.
Your calling is what I'm trying to say. Yeah. I have a lot of advocation, so it just comes out, that pay nothing. But anyway, so what I want to ask you is, you know, you talked a little bit about when you were young and it was difficult and it was challenging. And over time you were able to, sort of, as you said, I believe, change your outlook a little bit.
Yeah.
And that sort of was freeing to live a fuller life. You know, if there's any young people listening to us right now that maybe are struggling with some of those same things you did when you were young, you know, what would you say to them?
Yeah. So, I would say, you know, it's like, I understand that it's tough because, it is obviously difficult to live with this condition, but there are still things that, you know, you can do if you want to. There are many examples of people who have gotten their degrees who are in various fields doing what they want to do. There's people with disabilities who are traveling, who are able to go travel around the world and see different areas. So that's definitely possible. I think... definitely making sure that you're an advocate for yourself, because things are not going to get done unless you voice your concerns and make sure that people understand what you need to be successful. So when I think of like people who are younger, I think self-advocacy is very important, especially at a young age. It took me a while to get to that point, but if you start now, that's where you can make sure you get what you need. And also like, policy is important. Just to changing policy is what's going to, be the most impactful there. When people, I've seen it happen where people, it takes a while, but, there have been very many instances where advocates have really pushed for an issue and there's actually been legislation. There's, examples where I've seen that. So, it takes a while, but it does happen. Mm-hmm. That's what I would say. Try not to let like the disability hold you back, because there are still things you can do.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for sharing that with us. And I really commend you. If you don't mind me saying, you mentioned a couple times, you know, how important it was what your parents did. You know, in terms of their attitudes about living a full life, mm-hmm. and how impactful that was. And I hope it's okay. I give a little shout out to your mom. She's in the listening audience today. So we have a full studio audience. We have two people in the studio audience. One of my coworkers is in here too. Her name's Nina. So it's fun to have a live audience, but a little shout out to your mom, Sheila.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we get sort of towards the the penultimate part of our podcast, we really like to ask sort of a open-ended but philosophical question of, you know, what is your vision, you know, for the world, for, you know, particularly for maybe people with disabilities and other challenges? Where do you see the world in 10 years? What's your hope and dream?
So one thing like is I've mentioned a lot about how a lack of accessibility made my life very challenging, mm-hmm. Especially when I was in college. So I would like to see like every place just go above and beyond. Not, sometimes it's not enough to just meet the minimum standards. There's more you can always do to make things more accessible. So I would hope that in 10 years, like the everywhere I would go, I would not have any challenges or barriers because everything would be fully accessible. And it's not just physical accessibility, obviously digital accessibility and making sure people who are visually impaired also have access to things. So I would say just full accessibility of the community. The second thing is, while Minnesota has made a lot of strides in terms of public benefits, a lot of states still have asset and income limits for their Medicaid mm-hmm. programs. So I would hope that in 10 years, if you have a disability and you're on Medicaid, you don't have to ever worry about mm-hmm. losing it if you make more money mm-hmm. and work. That transition yeah. should not even be an issue. There's also, you know, like some of the Social Security benefits also have very mm-hmm. restrictive
sure.
eligibility. Like they define disability mm-hmm. based on how much money you can make, which obviously yeah. is not,
again, counterintuitive.
In my opinion, does not mm-hmm. make too much sense. So I'd hope all those penalties and restrictions are kind of pulled. And so mm-hmm. Ideally what would happen is someone is certified disabled, they get onto the Medicaid program, and then that's it. There's no mm-hmm. recertification. There's mm-hmm. no, you know, having to, you know, pay a premium or anything. Mm-hmm. That's just accessible for you. And so you can focus on other things.
Right.
Because your healthcare is taken care mm-hmm. of. That would be second thing. Third thing, more like just better transportation options, more transportation mm-hmm. options. So people can, mm-hmm. they don't, because right now, one of the challenges, and I've even faced it, like, I do have my own accessible vehicle, so my parents are able to drive me around, but even mm-hmm. they can't always do that.
Sure.
So having transportation options where I don't have to plan my schedule around available transportation, that would be another area that I think yeah. would make things a lot easier for people. And then this is obviously a little bit more challenging, but like changing other people's attitudes, because there's still a lot of bias and stereotypes about people with mm-hmm. disabilities. There's still, unfortunately, a lot of negative attitudes.
Sure.
So I think that needs to change as well. Mm-hmm. I hope that that is also something mm-hmm. where an employer doesn't see a person with a disability as someone that's not that mm-hmm. will not contribute, but actually values them.
Sure.
I think that those would be the four, like, vision. That would be the vision that I would have.
Yeah, it's a great vision. It's a great vision. I love it. For anybody that doesn't know, can you talk about what ACID, you mentioned it a couple of times, what that stands for and what that is? I think you said the ACID test.
Yeah, so basically with like medical assistance, ACID means like you can't have assets worth more than a certain
assets.
Assets, yeah.
I'm so sorry.
No, that's
I have a lot
okay.
of wax in my ears. So I'm thinking ACID, what does that stand for? Okay. So
yeah.
thank you for explaining it
yeah.
to me. I'm the one who doesn't know. So all right. Assets, yes.
Yeah, assets.
Asset limits.
Yep,
yes.
asset limits.
Of course, yeah. It would be great to see those thrown out the window. Yeah. It's counterintuitive, like
yeah.
we were saying. It's like, yeah. Get on this, go get a job, but not too good of a job.
Yeah, right,
you know,
exactly.
I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
You know,
so, I'm glad, you know, that advocates are continuing to push for these mm-hmm. kinds of things there. In the last two legislative session, quite a bit has been accomplished actually, in terms of some of these, issues that I've, brought up, in mm-hmm. Minnesota. I guess another part of the vision would be this would be nationwide. And there would be no issues no matter where you live. Because mm-hmm. I know, like, moving would be difficult as well. Like, depending on whether you have to move, you always have to then check whether how the benefits are going to work where you move. So That would be part of the vision as well, not just Minnesota, but just everywhere.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. And again, thank you for sharing your vision. You know, I really believe ableism is no different than white privilege. That if people don't know and just assume, oh, the world is great for everybody because it's great for me, then that isn't a truly inclusive, you know, environment. And you know, me, I am a white male, and I will never truly understand the depth of that privilege. I can educate myself and I can always try to do better. And, you know, and that's what you're talking about. So, and all the things you're doing are very in line with what we're doing at APSE. APSE, you know, our outcomes happen because of people that are passionate and want to take action. And, you know, that certainly is you. So I'm just saying, not to put you on the spot while we're on air here, but there are opportunities. And you may know that we have a public policy committee, in fact, among other things, you know, and you were talking about changing attitudes and knowledge. You know, I mean, you mentioned some case managers might not know what the options are. That's another big initiative that we're involved in, is just getting out into the community, getting out to the case managers, the families, everybody out in the community, and talking about customized employment and what is possible. So, yeah, thank you so much, Samuka. It's wonderful to meet you. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. Any last words before we do our official sign-off?
I'm trying to think if I forgot to mention anything. Oh, I guess the one last thing I would say is, like, they're, like, other advocacy experiences, it obviously doesn't just have to mean going to the Capitol and advocating. There are plenty of councils and things like that that people can join. So me specifically, I'm on the Minnesota Governor's Council of Developmental Disabilities. That's another organization that works to improve the system for people with disabilities, and they really do a lot to encourage self-advocacy. That's actually Partners in Policymaking is one of the initiatives through that. So I'm on the council there. I'm also on the Disability Advisory Council at Dakota County. So there are other ways, even at the local level, to get involved with advocacy. So that was the other thing I just wanted to mention.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And also, I wanted to circle back to, you had talked about the work and research you have done on Connect 700. If somebody out there listening is interested in Connect 700, where do they go?
So, if I'm not mistaken, so if you go on the state careers website, there is a tab that says Connect 700 for people with disabilities. That should have all the information on how to find, like, what the application is and everything. That's where I went to get my certificate. For that. So there's a bit of a process, but once you do that, then when you apply for any job on the state government website, they usually have, this is designated as Connect 700, so you would apply through that.
Okay.
So it's usually pretty, it should be pretty clear, but at least from my experience. So that's kind of how you'd go about it.
So state government website, Connect 700, you know, from there.
Yeah.
Yeah, right on. Well, great. Well, thank you again. Been a real pleasure. And I know this isn't the last time I'm going to see you. I'm already looking forward to the next time.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Okay. And I think I can speak for you and myself and all of APSE when I say, if you believe it, you can achieve it.